Good evening, Commissioners, Mr. Montoya, Jean, ladies and gentlemen of the audience and our television audience at home. I'd like to welcome you to our last meeting of this fiscal year. And this evening we are in San Luis at the library. And before I get on to the first item of the agenda, I would really like to say thank you to the Arroyo Grande City Council for letting us use their chambers last meeting. We had a delightful time there, and I got quite accustomed to the gavel. So I have my own tonight. Before we get on to public comment, I'd like to hear a motion that our minutes from our May 9th meeting be approved.
I so move.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All right, all in favor? Okay, opposed? Minutes for May 9th have been approved. Moving right along, anyone in the audience for public comment, please actually step forward. And we don't have a podium this evening, but feel free to take one of these seats and use the microphone. And please state your name and where you are from.
Thank you. Good evening to Chairman O'Brien and all the members of the Health Commission. My name is Biz Steinberg, and I serve as the Chief Executive Officer to the Economic Opportunity Commission. But tonight I am here pretending to be the healthcare advocate ombudsperson representing the program that we're finishing on your behalf and the county and community's behalf as of June 30th. As you're aware, I'm not Kathleen Aragon, and you are aware that she has moved on. We are greatly missing her. So I'm here tonight just for a couple of minutes to give you a couple of thoughts about that position and our recruitment right now, and then to give you an updated handout for your constituents for the summer, and we'll be back in July to give you the name of our new person. We were, just a moment on the recruitment, we were nearing completion of offering the position to a very competent, qualified, bilingual, bicultural person, and the person decided to go work for another nonprofit in our area. So they're very fortunate, and that consequently threw us into the recruitment process again. So we are in the middle of that. We will hopefully have our person ready for the beginning of the fiscal year. In the meantime, a couple of our family service staff advocates from our Head Start program, a couple of central administrative staff, we are all covering the needs of the community, north, south, central, and the coast, for the next couple of weeks as we get that completed. In May, I do want to update you, and we are getting the report sent off to Dr. Thomas's office, but in May we did make, and as I looked at the cumulative report, we did make presentations in Cambria, Paso, and San Miguel during May. We focused on those areas. From that came 24 referrals, and in those presentations we did see 318 people. So that, to me, seemed it was almost as large as back in November during that period of heightened work and referrals and advocacy. Referrals were made to the following, CHC Medical, CHCC Dental, Vision Care, Drug and Alcohol, and also Mental Health. So the other big thing that people really still need help on is keeping on filling out their forms for eligibility. So I guess you probably hear that every month. But that's a big area of assistance so that we get folks qualified and signed up for the support programs with their health needs. I wanted to report that the issues you've had the last couple of months with Clinica de Tolosa that I know Sarah's familiar with have really been worked out. Sochi really, and she's in the hospital, by the way, I forgot to mention that. Sochil was in a car accident. She's going to be okay. She's at Twin Cities and is doing well, but it was really kind of a very tragic, as any accident would be. But I wanted you to know before that happened, she really worked out the issues of eligibility with Clinica de Tolosa for the children's dental care. I know that was hanging over from last month, so I was trying to catch myself up and update you. Lots of referrals, actually, just in the last week, have been to CRLA, have been needs. We realized, you know, when you're not the one doing the program, that questions come about housing, not just health care. So we were able to make referrals to the appropriate agencies, and we have it very well in hand, and no one is as anxious for the replacement than I am.
Oh.
Okay? So I just wanted to take the time tonight to update you.
Okay.
And then I guess I'll leave these maybe with a few for the public and leave it with Jean.
Exactly, and if you can leave it with Jean, she'll make sure that we get them.
Great, and if there's any questions, please feel free to give us a call.
And you know what? Maybe if we could give one to our audiovisual person, and then he could shine that on the screen for
Excellent.
The viewers at home. Thank
Super.
You so much,
phone,
Ms. Steinberg.
Phone and have a good summer, but we see you back in July.
Okay.
Okay? Any questions?
I was going to say, before Ms. Steinberg leaves, do we have anything to... Okay.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks for all your work.
Thank you. And our next speaker, first of all, anyone else in the audience for public comment? Okay. Seeing no one, for that part of the agenda, I would like to invite our first speaker, Dr. Forsman, to talk about all-terrain vehicles. Dr. Forsman spoke with us last month in Arroyo Grande, and he has a proposal about all-terrain vehicles. And please come up and select a chair and a microphone, and welcome.
Thank you. First off, I'd just like to thank the Health Commission for inviting me to further talk about the ATV safety issue with children. I very briefly spoke last month, as you're aware, and I left my proposal with each of you. I did make more copies, but I will be leaving one here, and they said they will be making more copies. I'm going to leave my business card, and so if you have further questions, please give me a call anytime. I'd be happy to discuss it. Again, my name is Dr. Larry Forsman. I'm a local emergency physician. I've been working at Arroyo Grande and French hospitals since 1986. And during that period of time, as you can imagine, especially at Arroyo Grande, we have seen thousands, tens of thousands of ATV accidents in general since that period of time. And briefly, I just have a couple of real quick questions for the commission and for anyone else who wants to listen to my little spiel here. But the first question is what is the minimum age for riding ATVs on public lands in the state of California? And it's kind of interesting. There isn't any. There is no minimum age. Okay. And the second question that dovetails into that is, what is the maximum size of a machine, ATV vehicle, that any aged child can ride? Again, there isn't any. So literally, a 4-, 5-, 6-year-old little kid could be riding a 500cc machine and legally do it. Now, the only requirements by California Vehicle Code is that they have to be able to reach and operate the controls. Well, as you're aware, a lot of those controls just basically is, you know, switching the gears and running the throttle and the brakes with the hands. And so it's fairly easy for a little kid to run huge machines. And in fact, that is what happens because, you know, they're riding their father's ATV, they're renting whatever, so it could be any size. And one time last September, I was working a shift at Arroyo Grande, and I had three kids, all under the age of 10, who came in with fairly significant injuries. And I said, this is just nuts. And, you know, I just kind of got to me finally. I said, I'm going to find out exactly what's going on. So over the next few months, utilizing our billing service, I was actually able to pull up all the ATV injuries for everyone in general and came up with almost between January 1st, 2003 and September 30th, 2004. Actually, it came up with almost 1,300 ATV accidents that was treated between the two hospitals. And out of that, over 200 was for kids under the age of 14. And of that, 147 was at the Oceano Dunes by itself. So just huge, huge numbers, at least in my opinion. And so what I thought was a problem, I identified. And so that's what kind of started this. Interestingly, out of those numbers, out of that 147, I was able to get all sorts of statistics and basically found out that 103 of them were male and 44 female, so a very equal opportunity offender.
Wow.
The females are doing almost as good as the males. And very kind of surprising and yet not was the fact that these were not insignificant injuries. These were not, you know, little cuts and scrapes and things like that. I mean, and yes, as I found out from people who are opposed to me, that kids do injure themselves on skateboards and bicycles and things like this. But unfortunately, the chances of having a severe injury are much, much higher with ATVs. These are very, very powerful machines. Basically, one of the most disturbing things was that out of those 147, 60 of them had significant fractures. And that's important to know in kids because most of them were actually wrist fractures, and most of them involve the growth area. So these kids, unless they have pretty good alignment of the bones and stuff, they're at very substantial risk for literally lifelong disabilities. And so, you know, these are not inconsequential injuries. But it was other things. I'm major lacerations. Yeah, 30 of them had major lacerations all over the body, but especially the head, the face, the neck regions. A lot of them requiring going to the operating room. And on my proposal that I had handed out last time, I actually give specific examples, and I invite you to look at those sometimes. But just, you know, a few of them in, that really stand out was one of them was actually a little four-year-old, and that was my youngest one, a four-year-old riding an ATV. And they have to be riding by themselves because that is a California vehicle code. So it's not, there's no passengers allowed. So this little kid, 4 years old, was riding, ended up with chest, elbow, and leg injuries. I mean, 4 years old on an ATV, it just absolutely boggled me. But we also had a 7-year-old and a 13-year-old that were both admitted to intensive care units. We had a 12-year-old that actually had to go straight to the operating room because of genitalia injuries, as well as fractures, as well as lacerations. And a little 9-year-old that actually was airlifted via helicopter to French that had to go directly to the operating room for her injuries as well. So, again, very, very striking injuries. And the common factor, again, was that these were all children, all kids under the age of 14 that has potential for lifelong injuries. And that is one of the things that really bothers me. Basically, my proposal and what I'm looking for an endorsement of from this commission is that no person under the age of 14 years on or after this law is enacted shall operate an off-highway, all-terrain vehicle on California public lands. And that's kind of the gist of it. There's also a second part of it that says that kids between ages of 14 and 17 can operate them, but they have had to have gone through the ATV safety certificate program. And the reason I came up with these numbers and this is actually taken from a California vehicle code statute that has been completely ignored. It was enacted in 1988. Actually, it was passed in 1988, enacted into law in 1990. And having spoken with Andrew Zilke, he is the superintendent at the Oceano Dunes, has never been enforced. And it was real interesting because I just talked to Andy just a week and a half ago, and they're finally looking into trying to enforce this. But as it stands now, the only way it could be enforced is to arrest the kid. There's no mention here about arresting or citing the adult. So he doesn't feel real comfortable about leading six-year-olds away in handcuffs. I'm being a little bit facetious, but, you know, even to give citations, what are you going to do? You write a citation for this little kid? So they're actually looking into the parks, the Oceano Dunes people. They are really, really doing a great job. I mean, they're doing the best they can with what they have. And one of the things they're looking at is trying to get this ATV safety certificate off and running. It is a law. It is not offered here. When I went online, I actually found out that you had to go to Bakersfield or Lemoore for the closest classes. And it's just amazing that they require this, but it's not even offered here. So my opinion is that this law, even though it's been in effect for 15 years, is totally ineffective, and it's going to require the next level of of enforcement, and that is, it's real simple. You, just like when, you know, driving a car, you have to be 16 or whatever, and that you'll have to meet a certain age. And I just kind of arbitrarily came up with the underage of 14, and to be frank, only people that's going to determine the age is going to be legislators, because it will take that. And whatever they come up with, even if they came up with something less, I will be happy myself. I have spoken with numerous people. I've talked with rangers. Again, I talked with Andrew Zilke, who is at the Oceano Dunes. I've actually talked with Sam Blakesley, and they are reviewing it right now. I have also spoken with the County Medical Society, and they have endorsed it. I spoke with local emergency physicians, orthopedic specialists. They are also in favor of it. And again, I'm looking to this body to also support it. I've also been in contact with the governor's office and talked to a nice gentleman named Phil. And Phil said, well, this sounds interesting, was the word he used, and said, go ahead and send me the proposal. I'm in the process of doing it. I just talked to him last week. So that's kind of where I'm at. You know, whatever that this, if this commission can help me, I'd be greatly appreciative. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them now. Or if you want to contact me at home, at work, or whatever, again, I'll leave my business cards over there at the table, so it'll be available, and also give them to me last month.
Dr. Foreman, could you read for everyone here? Now, some of us were not at the meeting last month, and so they didn't get a copy of your proposal. But just so we're all on the same page, could you read your proposal, and then we'll ask for questions and see where people are in terms of an action response on it.
Okay. My proposal A is that no person under the age of 14 years, on or after this law is enacted, shall operate an all-highway all-terrain vehicle on California public lands. And just as a little sidelight, the reason I had to include that is that ATVs are those classic three- and four-wheelers that you see at the dunes. But as you also go to the dunes, and I invite everyone to go there and look and see if there is a problem, that you'll see a lot of dirt bikes. You'll also see go-karts. You'll see sand rails. Not too many kids drive the sand rails, but there's many different types of vehicles out there probably tonight, being driven, and it could be a big problem. So that's the reason I had to have all off-highway and all-terrain vehicles to be inclusive. And then my proposal B is that California Vehicle Code 38503 shall be amended to include ages 14 through 17. And again, what that basically entails is that there's a couple of restrictions. Number one, that person who age 14 through 17 has to have, or in the process of getting, an ATV safety certificate, or they have to be driving under the direct supervision of an adult who has that certificate. And so that's the proposal.
Okay. Commissioners, questions?
I have a question. Are most of these kids that come in, have they been wearing a helmet? I mean, at least a helmet to protect them?
Yes, and that's a very good question. It is mandatory now that all ATV riders, not just kids, but adults, all of them have to be wearing helmets. There's other requirements as far as the vehicles have to be registered. Also, they have to have an orangish, reddish safety flag. But, yes, all of them do have helmets. And to California's credit, it was enacted almost 20 years ago, and it has made a huge difference. And as, again, a little sidelight, at this coming weekend, Dr. Steve Hansen is addressing the American Medical Association in Chicago. Actually, he's not addressing, but he's going to be working with a New York delegation to make it a federal complete across the United States, because there's many states that don't even require helmets on ATVs at this point. Not for adults, not for kids.
Commissioner Wood.
Are specifications laid down for the helmets, that they're Snell approved? Or?
You know, I remember seeing the statute. I don't remember. I'm going to assume that there is ASI, or Snell requirements.
Okay. My second question is whether what arguments have you run into against your proposal?
Well, I merely was doing this starting back in January, and actually, I was always preaching to the choir, so I didn't really have any arguments until I happened to go on a local radio talk show, and boy, did I get comments. About 75% of the people called in, I would say past upset. I mean, they were angry. And the main thing is that I was called a rogue doctor, and also that I was destroying families, and also that basically the gentleman who is the president of the Friends of the Oceano Dunes called in from San Jose and said that, you know, my numbers were so low that basically what he said, it was a justification because there was 1.4 million people at the dunes last year, and that's a small number of kids being injured. Oh, okay. So I was a little bit taken back by that.
What was your total number in your survey that you did, 1,300?
There was about 1,300.
Over what period?
And that was would have been 20 months.
20 months.
And
of those 1,300, how many were under 14?
Well, a grand total, it would have been 200, approximately one-fifth of them. About 20% were kids under the age of 14. Now, interestingly, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, they actually have done research into this, and actually it was just on the local TV just last Friday. They are looking more into this, but there was an article in the Tribune last January that spoke to that, and they said they figured about 25% of the injuries were under the age of 16, which that would probably be pretty close. I excluded 14, 15, and 16-year-olds. So we're probably pretty close there. And they mentioned, 125,000 people are, going to the emergency rooms and 2,500 deaths and some really horrendous numbers. So actually, this is being looked at by the feds as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Commissioner Hotel.
Yes, you said that off-terrain vehicles would also be included in this restriction of 14 and under, right?
Correct, yeah. Off-highway vehicles.
All
slash
right.
ATVs,
all right.
All-terrain vehicles.
Ranchers and farmers have sons and daughters that drive tractors who are less than 14. Now, would this apply to them, too?
Well, first off, it only applies to California public lands. So if they're on private property, they can do almost anything they want. Now, obviously, if they are driving an ATV or a dirt bike and they're riding on a highway or something along those lines, they're already in violation.
No, I'm talking about the normal part of work that and daughters under 14 drive tractors.
Right. And, first off, it doesn't apply to tractors. But, again, if they're on private property, it does not pertain to them.
Mr. Hill.
I think maybe part of the point that he's making there is that, some kids are very qualified to operate vehicles, as big as a tractor. The truth of the matter is those kids are taught and supervised and watched very closely, and they're not going, crazy jumping sand dunes. I think that's part of the question here. I have to admit my bias, too. I'm an emergency physician, and I see these kids with horrible injuries, and I go, is there some way we can help prevent this? I don't think it's destroying families to, make people be careful about what their kids are doing. And we have a very special situation at the dunes where kids are not supervised, and there's lots of dangerous things that can happen there, in part because their parents are intoxicated at the time the kid's out there on the vehicle. And the only real opposition to this that I've heard is, what's the fair age? Is it 14? Is it 12? Honestly, I don't know, because kids are different. A lot of kids are more mature at age 12 than some kids at age 14. So you got to start someplace, and I'm not sure where's the right place to start, but I think 14 is fine. And you know that I'm supportive of this and have been through there. I was just curious to hear what opposition you've heard, too, and how it's been directed. Has anybody been talking about what's the right age, or is there another approach to take to get more supervision, or I don't know, what other things have you heard?
During, again, really the only time I've had negative feelings about this expressed as on that radio show, and not one of the 75% of them, and again, I'm going to say over that period of time, I was on for an hour and a half, and I'm going to say there was probably 9, 10, 11 people who spoke against. No one had actually came up with a minimum age. Basically, 100% of them said that my children are very mature, my children are always under supervision, my children won't be in an accident, my children are perfect, basically. And so, you know, they are not the problem. It's, you know, I'm being a little facetious, but it was, they just, and the one, again, the guy, the Friends of Dunes, he had actually mentioned six-year-olds, 7-year-olds, his kids, who had done it and done just fine, thank you. And he pointed that out to me very quickly. So I don't know if he would definitely be in favor of any minimum age, but my response to them, my response to you, my response to the public in general, don't believe me. Go to the dunes, and if you want, go this evening, because they're out there right now, but especially on weekends. Weekends, especially holiday weekends, where there's 40,000 people out there. There's more traffic there than there is on the freeway. And tell me, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when the adults are out there, you know, putting down a few, you think those kids have run out of energy? No. And what do those kids do? They're going to do just like the adults do. They're going to go out there and see how much air they can catch. They're going to see how much they can slide on the slip face. They're going to try and do everything that they saw the adults do because I'm sure it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun until you crash. And that's the real problem. And that's where the supervision is gone, especially at certain times of the day, is that the adults are doing what adults do and kids are doing what kids do. And so, you know, I do not want to see the dunes closed. Secondly, I don't want to see the ATVs thrown off there. I just want to help kids. And basically the moniker for this is a kids care bill. And, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, adults aren't doing supervision like they should, but it's just a fact of life. And I think people just need to go out there and see for themselves. And they can judge for themselves if there's a problem or not.
Problem with the timer here, so please ignore that. I live near the beach in that area, and I hear the ambulances all weekend long, so I don't have to go down there and see anything firsthand to know that there is a problem. And I also used to work near the hospital, and I hate to say this, and I don't want anyone to take this the wrong way, but it was commonly said that was how a Rio Grande Community Hospital stayed open, because of all of the ATV accidents. And I know that wasn't really the truth, but there were so many, and it was such a problem that we know the emergency room was always filled with ATV accidents. So I completely support your cause.
Commissioner Warren.
I just had a question about the certificate program. I'm really curious as to who is it that offers those and why they're so far away.
Well, interestingly, it's actually the ATV Safety Institute. And the ATV Safety Institute is a manufacturer-sponsored industry. Basically, John Deere, Yamaha, Suzuki, Honda, all the people who make ATVs, there's 6 or 7 of them. And they actually have a director down in Irvine, very, very nice gentleman. I actually have his name available. And they put out pamphlets about all sorts of ATV safety issues and stuff. And when they sell a brand new ATV, they actually will give you a rebate so you can take the course. Again, the real problem is that this course, it's a 4-hour course, very intensive, tells all the do's and the don'ts and what to do and what not to do. And again, the real unfortunate thing is that it's just not offered well. They were charging $125 without the rebate. The state of California passed a law that went into effect January 1, 2005, I mean real recently, that said they were going to do it for $3 or free or something like that. It's not happened. So that's kind of where the safety certificate came from, and that's actually how it's not been used.
Well, it's just one of the things that comes to mind. Like Dave was saying, with kids on ranches and stuff, they used to have to take a hunter safety course. before they could get their hunting license. And so it seems like it would certainly make sense for everybody, for the kids between 12 and 14, to be working on getting a certificate. And it just seems an opportunity for us to do some education, you know, if this were to happen.
And I'm very, very supportive. I mean, obviously, my hope is that if I get enough endorsements and I can convince the politicians to back this, that there'll be some hearings, and Mr. O'Dell's concerns and anybody else's concerns, you know, will be discussed and ironed out and come up with a reasonable policy that's fair. And that's, again, I look for fairness and I look for protecting kids. And that's my only agenda. I mean, I've been accused of a few things, but when it comes down to it, I just try to help kids.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you for coming back to do a more in-depth presentation. When we saw you in Arroyo Grande last month, it was only in the public comment sector, and you had 3 minutes to share in a thumbnail sketch about this proposal. And it's a very serious issue. I think my mouth dropped a little bit more toward the table last month when I heard about the youngest child being 4 years old. And it's an eye-opening situation that certainly some people have been very privy to, but I think many of us had not known the depth or the severity and a lot of the specifics about the situation. So thank you very much for bringing it to us.
Before you leave, too, I just wanted to say that the last traumatic death that I saw in a child less than 10 was caused by an ATV accident as well. That's part of, you know, it was a family friend that it happened to and was not on public property, it was on private property, but still, you know, it was a tragedy that could be avoided and, you know, should never have happened. I was just curious what the ATV Safety Institute may say about your proposal, or what people from the various manufacturers may say about the proposal as well, too. I don't know if you've submitted any of those kind of places or asked them for comment. I'm anxious to hear what the opposition has to say.
Well, I spoke with, I got so many names here, and having seen, I'm not quite for sure which one of these names it was, the gentleman. Seemed like a very reasonable individual. He was supportive. And again, at that time, when I first started talking to him, I was a little bit wishy-washy as far as the minimum age. And I said, well, I'm kind of looking in the 10 to 16 here. You know, I had not actually done the research because he was one of my first phone calls. But he was receptive to, especially when I told him about the 4-year-olds and the 5-year-olds and the 6-year-olds and stuff like this. My impression was that he was receptive. What he said, though, is something that they would seriously have to look into. Quote, I mean, that was the word, seriously have to look into. So, I mean, they were not committed. But then again, he didn't, you know, tell me to go put my head in the sand.
I mean, I think it's easy for us to vote to support you, and it's easy for most people in the healthcare field to vote to support you. But the real question is a political one more so than a medical question. I mean, it's obvious to us that there are preventable injuries and deaths that we can address here without taking away people's privilege to ride ATCs. We just want them to do it in a supervised fashion. We don't want them to do it, you know, like a bat out of hell on the dunes, because when you're out on the farm property, you know, you're much more cognizant because mom and dad are watching you or know what's going on, or you go straight down the road fast. You don't go jumping and on places where you've never been, where the terrain is unsafe. And that's part of the whole gist here. It's not to say they can't ride them. It's to say they can't ride them in an unsafe fashion on terrain that's dangerous.
Right.
And, again, I'm anxious to hear what the opposition has to say. And I don't know what the right age is, just like you. I don't know if it should be 14 or 12 or where, but we got to start someplace. So,
And that's why, again, I was kind of hoping that in some kind of legislative hearings or something, and, again, I did let both Abel Maldonado's and Sam Blakesley's office know that I would be happy to go up to Sacramento and at least give them the information that I have and my spin on it. But, you know, whatever the 120 legislators in the state of California think is best with the input from all parties, you know, I just think that it would undoubtedly be better than what it is now.
Do you have somebody to carry the bill yet?
I don't.
You don't.
And that's, again, I sure have approached them. I have not got them off the dime, the nickel, or the penny, but that's why I'm looking to you as well as other agencies to maybe get them moving. Now, it will not happen this year. That is, you know. So what will happen is I get hopefully more people lined up here, hopefully, you know, individual concerns and groups and like that, that I can go back to Mr. Blakeslee and, you know, in December say, listen, will you please introduce this? Hopefully he'll be aboard. What I also do have, I have a legislature, and I think, again, you probably know, Tom, there's one of the Democrats who is very helpful with the California chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, who has been very supportive of us in the past, and I'm hoping that it would be sponsored by both a Democrat and a Republican. You know, the red and blue together goes a long ways. Having said that, also, I would love to get Arnie on board as well, at least to not say, you know, he's going to veto right off the bat, because if he does that, I'll probably just stop. But anyway, so that's, I'm hoping to get, you know, the legislatures to go ahead and do that.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking about when that it's a nonpartisan issue. It's everybody's children. But when many of the ranchers have been very, very supportive over the years of these hunter safety classes. So I think that coming through with that kind of approach is real common sense kind of thing that they've been and probably didn't even know that it was out there, that these type of ATV certifications were something that could they could support with their kids, too. So I would like to see some pressure put on those groups to become active with that and see where that might take us, too.
Well, that is definitely one of the things I'm hopeful is that, you know, obviously this pertains only to public lands, but, you know, for all the private lands and stuff like this, it's still an excellent course. And hopefully when people find out that it's even available, that, you know, they'll utilize it, you know, because it just may save lives, limbs.
Doesn't the statute that you quoted say that people under the age of 14 already are supposed to be directly supervised by somebody who has passed the course if they haven't done it themselves?
Actually, what it is, the difference between the two vehicle codes is the 14 to 18 says that, yes, as far as safety certificates, they either have to be in the process of taking it, have it, or be with an adult that has already have it under their direct supervision. Under the age of 14, it has to be a parent or a guardian. That's the distinction between the two. Or they, and there's one other one, too, is that they can, if they have a safety certificate from another state, that is the other final thing.
Do we have anyone in the audience who would like to make a public comment on this topic? Okay. Seeing no one, commissioners, how do you feel about taking an action on this tonight, or would you feel like you need to digest the facts a little bit more before we take an action on it? Commissioner O'Dell?
Yeah, I'd like to see us help get the ball rolling.
Okay.
Yes, I do. I would too.
Okay. So I have a motion to support this action item and your proposal. From Dr. Foreman, and so I have a first and a second, and all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, seeing none opposed, the proposal passes for the support of the health from the support of the Health Commission.
Thank you. Well, thank you, and
thank you,
the
Dr. Foreman.
Not only do I thank you, but the kids thank you.
And thank you for being willing to take this one on. Okay. We've all read in the newspapers and heard on the television and in the media great concern about the nursing shortage. The nursing shortage nationally and the nursing shortage within our own state of California. And in preparation for this evening's meeting, I really looked at some different sources in terms of where are we in California. And I have an article from the Center for the Health Professions at the University of California in San Francisco. And it says that based on California's projected population growth, researchers from the UCSF Center for California Health Workforce Studies estimate an additional 43,000 registered nurses will be needed by the year 2010, and an additional 74,000 by 2020 to maintain a stable ratios of RNs to population. In the same published article, there was a statement about the state's population will increase 23% between 1998 and 2010, and 40% between 1998 and 2020. And they estimate that the future shortage of nurses, by combining an analysis in the 1996 National Sample Survey of Registered Nurses with projections from the Department of Finance, the additional nurses estimated to be needed to maintain the state's 1996 ratio of 566 employed registered nurses per 100,000 California residents. So that's a pretty sobering number. And I know that there are certainly different numbers being publicized, but I think the common thread that runs through all of the information that's out there is that we really need to take a very serious look at what we are going to do to recruit new individuals into the profession, as well as to retain those individuals that are already in the profession. And so this evening we have a panel of nurses, and I also have invited Betsy Umhofer, and she is representing Congresswoman Lois Capps' office. And then after Betsy reads us a letter from Lois Capps, Dr. Mary Parker, who is the Dean of the School of Nursing at Cuesta College, will give a short update on the local status of what's going on in our own county and what is being done to both recruit and retain nursing students at Cuesta College. So welcome, Mrs. Umhofer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I do have a letter tonight from the Congresswoman, who is, of course, in Washington, D.C. But before I begin with that, for those of you that don't know, since we're talking about nursing, Congresswoman Capps earned her nursing degree at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. She worked as a nursing instructor in Oregon and was the head nurse at the Yale New Haven Hospital. And she also worked as a school nurse in Santa Barbara County before she came to Congress. So she has been a nurse for over 40 years. And the letter that she sends is the following. Dear members of the Health Commission, thank you for this opportunity to participate in this discussion of local health issues and the nursing shortage. My duties in Washington, D.C. prevent me from attending your meeting. But this letter will give you my perspective on the nursing shortage and some of the efforts I have made at the federal level to address it. Nurses are the backbone of the public health infrastructure, the first line of defense in healthcare. But with an aging nursing workforce approaching retirement and a dwindling supply of new nurses, we are facing an incredible shortfall of well-trained, experienced nurses. To make matters worse, this shortage will peak just as the baby boom generation begins to retire and require a greater amount of care. We are truly at a crossroads. Without enough nurses, hospitals and doctors must see fewer patients. Many rural areas depend on advanced practice nurses to provide primary health care, since there aren't enough doctors. And several reports have concluded what many healthcare professionals have known for years, that there is a direct link between the number of registered nurses and the quality of care provided in our nation's hospitals. We simply cannot afford a shortage now or in the future. In the 107th Congress, that was in 2001, I introduced and the Congress passed legislation, the Nurse Reinvestment Act, to significantly increase the resources we devote to recruiting and retraining and training nurses. I designed this legislation to support nurses at all levels, from the certified nurse assistants to the advanced practice nurses and nurse faculty. I worked hard to educate my colleagues about the challenges you and nursing students face throughout the country. But the funding for nurse education programs is a paltry $150 million. In 1974, during the last serious nursing shortage, Congress appropriated $153 million for nurse education programs. In today's dollars, that would be worth $592 million, approximately four times what we are spending now. But funding alone will not solve the problem. We must also make significant changes to the nursing workplace. We need to make sure nurses are not overworked by requiring adequate staffing levels per patient. I've introduced the Quality Nursing Care Act, H.R. 1372, in this Congress to direct hospitals to work with their nursing staff to develop staffing level standards that will be enforced by Medicare. I will continue working hard on this issue. I know I can count on your support and this, and look forward to working with you. Now, I've brought copies of this letter for everyone, and in addition, I brought a sheet that shows you how to track a bill if you'd like to follow the progress of H.R. 1372 or any other bill, and also how to look up the details of the Nurse Reinvestment Act. Finally, I would like to ask that after the conclusion of the WISE panel that's to follow me, and Dr. Mary Parker, I include her in the WISE group as well, I would ask that the Health Commission send a letter to the Congresswoman about your views at the conclusion of the overview that you are receiving tonight, because she would very much like to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Any questions? Commissioner O'Dell.
Well, one thing you didn't mention, California has already done the staffing ratio for the hospital.
They have, and they just did last week, the court,
the court
upheld that.
Right,
this will underscore that. It certainly won't trump the California, but it will apply to other states as well, should it pass. More states than just California would benefit.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? Thank you very much
You're
for coming,
welcome.
And give our gratitude to Congresswoman Capps for sending a letter.
I certainly will. We'll look forward to yours.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'd like to introduce Dr. Mary Parker. Before our panel comes forward, she's going to let us know about what's going on at Cuesta College in terms of recruiting and new nursing students and retaining the ones that are already enrolled in the program. Dr. Parker, thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for having me. I noticed there are two docs here. Are any of y'all nurses?
Yes.
You are, and you are, Ms. Hayes?
Actually, on the commission, Commissioner Enns, Lynn Enns, is also a nurse.
Okay.
She's not here tonight.
Okay. Well, in terms of what we're doing recruitment-wise, Cuesta has taken its commitment to the community, because we are a community college. In my opinion, we've taken it quite seriously. And one of the things that we started about 4 years ago was careers in caring, and that's where we have interested high school students who, and they are students that are interested in health careers. So it's a select group. They are selected by their community or their counselors to come to Cuesta. We have representatives from between 10 and 12 different professions within healthcare, and they aren't necessarily careers that we offer at Cuesta. You know, they are trying to expose them to the many opportunities that are available in our community, in the whole healthcare arena. And we have had anywhere from 90 to about 120 juniors and seniors that have come to that. And that is not just a recruitment for Cuesta, but more an exposure to healthcare. Mm-hmm. And the idea from that came out of, I guess, when we were talking with some of the HR people locally, that several of the hospitals mentioned that they have more than 200 job descriptions in our hospitals, and our hospitals are really relatively small. And yet people know about nurses and doctors, but they really don't know about all the opportunities that are available in healthcare. So that has been something that we've done that's been very successful. We go to all of the high schools that invite us to their career days. And sometimes they haven't invited us, and we've heard about it, and we've invited ourselves. But again, to expose people, you know, high school students, to the opportunities that exist in healthcare. Y'all are probably well aware that healthcare will be the fifth largest profession, or the fifth largest industry in the United States. And so that's huge. And when people think of it as just being nurses, doctors, maybe a physical therapist or, you know, a few other things, I think that oftentimes young people are limited in their scope and just because they haven't been exposed. And then I believe that we have been successful. We have 118 qualified students on our wait list right now. We did just this. Last May, add an additional 10 students to our nursing class. It's the class of 07, the one that is starting this fall, so that we will be admitting 57 students this fall. 56 are new students, one student's a returning student, and that's the largest class that Cuesta, you know, has ever had. I will say that I'm not aware of any nursing program in the state that doesn't have a wait list. So I would like to, you know, say that it's our fabulous recruitment that has resulted in the increased numbers. Probably some of it is economic driven, you know, people knowing, oh, I can get a job if I'm a nurse. Some of it is the result of the wonderful advertising that companies like Johnson & Johnson have done, you know, that have had lots of national press. And then no small part of it is all the press that has occurred as a result of there being an acute nursing shortage and people realizing, you know, I can get a job, you know, as a nurse, and all of the opportunities, and you're going to hear from your WISE panel. I don't put myself in that WISE category, but you will hear from the WISE panel all the opportunities that do exist, you know, for a nurse. One of the problems, and I'm sure that y'all are well aware of it, is that community colleges have had a hard time in terms of retention of students, and we are certainly not alone in that battle. The BSN programs run an attrition rate of about 16%. We run an attrition somewhere between 20, some colleges as high as 30%. We at Cuesta feel like that we've gone a very long way to address that retention and keeping students in the program. And that has been the result of, you may be aware, we had an H-1B grant in which we were able to hire a person who is not a faculty person but is an RN. And she has done case management for students because when the physician was speaking about families and, you know, talking about all their children are well supervised and all their children are good and all of their children probably are beautiful and keeping with all of Garrison Keillor's things and all of that, we have found that oftentimes the at-risk student really does struggle with identifying or even understanding that they might be at risk. They frequently, I want to be a nurse. My neighbor tells me I will be a great nurse. I want to be a nurse. And all of those are really very admirable, but they don't necessarily keep you in a nursing program. So one of the things that we've done through this H-1B grant through case management is when students aren't doing well on a test, we bring them in, we talk with them, why aren't you doing well? What is your strategy for success? And it's proven to be a very successful model. And as a result of that, we have 10 more students going into our second semester than we've had in the last 5 or 6 years. So we feel like that we do have a model that is successful. Unfortunately, the college doesn't have the funding to be able to support, you know, someone who doesn't have a teaching load, who is doing is doing case management for students. So we are looking, I'm sure aware of the money that Governor Schwarzenegger has earmarked for nursing expansion, and we're going to be doing a collaborative with 5 other community colleges, and our piece of that would be to be able to hire someone who could come do that case management, to really do that hands-on with students to help them, you know, to be successful. And Riverside had a similar position, Riverside Community College, and they had the same result, you know, where so it wasn't just a fluke that we've been successful. We did that independently, but we all ended up, you know, with the same results. As I did want to mention also that with the 10 students that we added, we were able to do that with the 6 hospitals that are in our community, including Mee Memorial and Marion, and then all of the San Luis Obispo hospitals. And so it has been a collaborative effort with everybody contributing money, including Cuesta, to be able to hire a faculty person to support those additional 10 students. So we have had strong community support. I think when you're talking about student retention, when Deborah asked me to speak on this and she said, well, you can take about 5 minutes, we could probably spend weeks on student retention, and that wouldn't just be in nursing programs. It would be probably in any, you know, rigorous kind of program. There are multiple reasons, multiple things that students come into our programs with, and helping them to be successful, because they do. They very much desire to be a nurse. They, you know, are good, caring people, but sometimes it takes more than, you know, wishing to make things so. And so what we need to do is help them to develop specific plans that help them to be successful. So I could go on like another week, but maybe you have questions.
Commissioner O'Dell.
Tell us about your program. You're a 2-year program?
We're an associate degree program, which is a 2-year program. Although it's 2 years of nursing, most of our students have spent anywhere from a year, some of them to 2 years, doing their prerequisites to come into the program.
And then how new are you? I mean, how long have you been in existence?
The Cuesta program, yeah. Since 1967.
Did you graduate a class this June?
This last June? Yeah. Yes, we did.
How many?
And it was 35, it was May, but 35 students.
35 students.
Correct.
And you have 57 in your first year now? Or going
correct. We have 57 in the first year that have been admitted, and we have 45 going into the second year.
And then you have a waiting list of?
118.
Wow. How many men? What's the percentage of men?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I do know that in this freshman class right now, there are 9 men in the class. And then in the second semester, there are 4 men.
Thank you.
We, just for your information, tend to be statistically higher on men than most programs in the state.
Commissioner Wood.
Is there a BSN program available?
Yes. There's a BSN program through Dominguez Hills that's an online program. There is not a live program, although we did with another grant, the Gray Davis's money, did part of our grant was to bring a BSN program live here, and it did not, it was not as successful as any of us would like it to be. It only has about four or five students in it. And there's a lot of discussion going on in the state as to why someone wouldn't get their BSN. And some of it has to do with there's no monetary incentive for doing that. You know, community colleges in California, 70% of the nurses in California come from community colleges. And the only places where they have high BSN enrollment, RN to BSN enrollment, are places, for example, Ventura. Ventura has a community hospital that gives a pay differential for people that have a BSN.
But that doesn't necessarily follow with everyone, that you get more money if you get a BSN.
Actually, it does. It does not follow.
Yeah.
Correct. It gets into union issues, same work,
yeah.
same pay.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that professionally we probably really need to give some thought to. Not, I mean, to look at it in terms of what's best for the union, for the profession that we can work within. You know, union environments also with.
And does it? How long does it take a person? Let's say that graduates Cuesta to do the BSN, if they do it online, as you say.
Well, there's also the University of Phoenix, and the University of Phoenix is a modular, it's a private college, and it's much faster, and it's my understanding you can do the University of Phoenix in about a year. The Dominguez Hills program is probably 2 to 3 years, going part-time.
Yeah. And the other question I had for you was, how does your wait list work? If I'm a student in the 118 that didn't make the cut.
You've got a number, and that number grows up. I mean,
it grows
up.
So yes. If they hang in there.
So if you're 118, then you are admitted into the program.
Okay.
And the way that we are structured currently, and I predict that there's probably going to be a change on that, everyone who has a C or better in their prerequisites does get accepted into the, or is put on that wait list, with the ones with the higher GPA going first. But everybody eventually, you know, does get through. I think that there is going to be a letter coming from the chancellor's office that does address students having to have a higher than 2.5 in order to come in to a nursing program. And so we'll have to validate that and work through the community college process to have that happen. I will tell you that what we are doing is meeting with all those students who have less than a 2.5 and talking with them about, okay, what are you going to do to make yourself successful now?
And one last one, if I may.
Go right
Forgive
ahead.
So your acceptance ratio is... In other words, if you have 100 apply, how many get accepted? How is your...
I'm not sure. If we had a 100, it's rare for us to get people to decline, if that's what you're asking. So.
Well, I'm saying, I guess what I'm asking is how many, typically, how many applied last for this new class, and how many were accepted?
Well, there were 150 applied. But of that 150, about, I think it was 88 or 90, were qualified to get onto the wait list.
I see.
But the important thing, and it's a good thing for the community, is that many colleges have a wait list, and those wait lists can be very fluid, you know, so that you have 118 students, but then by the time you've accepted a class, you maybe end up with only... very few people on the wait list. Our wait list seems to be very solid. When I talk to other directors in the state, our wait list does not move the way other people's do. And so that's probably a reflection of the fact that most of these are stable, and by stable, I mean they live here in the community, they're committed to the community, and they don't have the option of going other places. So from an industry collaboration, that makes it worthwhile for hospitals here locally to collaborate with us, because most of our students do, in fact, stay here.
Thank you.
You talk about your attrition rate being like 20% now.
It's not now. It had been. Actually, at one point, it was 40%.
Okay. I know that there was one time, too, where your attrition rate was almost zero.
Correct.
And that changed because of the approach to admitting students. I wonder if you would talk to that a little bit.
I need to back up. I'll be happy to talk about that. The community college system is different than the CSUs or the UCs. The community college is an open access system, and it is an open opportunity for everyone to get an education. Doesn't mean that everybody gets through, but everybody has an opportunity. And so there was a lawsuit brought against the community colleges, and I want to say it was in the early 90s. It may have been before that, but there was a lawsuit brought against the community college system in which there were what was called artificial barriers. So everybody had to get rid of all prerequisite material that they could not document or prove meant that a student's had, if, in other words, if students didn't meet certain criteria, then they would have only a 25% chance of success. We weren't able to document anything because all we had at that point was very, very strong academic students. So we couldn't say that, oh, you really have, I mean, we could have said you had to have a 3.5 to be successful, but we couldn't have said you had to have a 3.0 or 2.5. Subsequent to that.
So your system was a merit-based system at that point.
Pardon?
Your admission system was a merit-based system.
It was an academic-based system.
You took the best students you could get.
Yes. And I will say I've been at Cuesta for 35 years. I still believe that our graduate is as good a graduate as we had, you know, before we had any change. But because of the changes that have occurred, it did result in students coming to us who weren't as well prepared. And so that's one of the things that we have certainly attempted to address. And there has been a great deal of research done on nursing students in the state of California because our story isn't unique. And when you look at the nursing shortage, one of the things to realize is that you have the system that is educating most of the nurses does have a pretty significant attrition rate. And so I believe that that is going to be being addressed, but it's had to be backed up by research.
Dr. Parker, what do you find as some of the most common reasons when someone, a nursing student, comes to talk with you or the case manager that you are using at this point about some of the frustrations, some of the reasons that he or she would decide not to continue in the nursing program? What are some of the most frequent things that come up?
We've broken them up into academic and non-academic. I'm willing to try to address the academic issues. I'm not sure that I can address their pregnancies, their divorce, you know, life happening, you know, those kinds of things. We had a class 3 years ago who had 11 people in the first year that dropped out for non-academic reasons, you know, like they had an ill husband, they had kids that needed them, that sort of thing. We haven't had that as much again, and we have done a lot of trying to educate people on what a nurse does. You know, when you've taken a valuable nursing seat is not the time to find out you really don't like touching people. And, you know, so, well, but, I don't say that facetiously, but, you know, that has happened. And so we try to, we do an orient, I hear laughter behind me.
It's the nurses.
I know, because they know. I mean, there are things that nurses do that are not for everyone. I want you to find that out before you've taken a valuable seat.
Yes.
And we have tried to educate. We have 500 pre-nursing students identified at Cuesta College. Now, I don't think they're all pre-nursing students, but we have tried to educate them on what a nurse does. So there are the non-academic issues. There are the academic issues. You know, the student who didn't realize that they would have to read their textbook. That's very common. You know, the student who, and we have students in this county that come out of honors programs that tell me, you know, I was an honor student. There's something wrong that you're not testing me correctly. You know, so I do think that it is a rigorous program. I don't think that it's an unreasonable program. It's also a story that I don't, I mean, that I hear from other directors throughout the state, but it's oftentimes a workload issue. Students who have English as a second language are definitely at risk. Students who are working 40 hours a week, if they're working more than 20 hours a week, you know, that is, it's very, very hard for them. And you know, it's sort of, we're all in a much more hectic time. And I think the students only reflect that, you know, so that it's hard, very hard for them.
And I think that's a great thing that this Careers in Caring and with representatives from the nursing program going to high schools for career.
That actually, the high school students come to us.
Oh, great.
We give them lunch.
Hey.
I mean,
that's
not a great lunch, but it's a lunch.
Yeah.
And they have stations where they go to 10 to 12 different people who try to convince them of the merits of their profession. Mm. Lou Tadone, for example, often speaks for the docs, and he is always, you know, they just, you know, they're all ready to sign up. So we're probably going to dump Lou because... We want them nursing. No. We have multiple.
They're all ready for pre-med. Huh?
Yeah. Oh, they are. They are. They are so there because of him. So we have a number of professions. We'll have a physical therapist there. Sports medicine is very big. Physical therapy. We have a dental hygienist, ophthalmology. So, you know, there's
That's kind of wonderful.
A vast array.
And it's great, like you said, to give people an experience of the breadth and the depth of careers in health, because you're right. I think when you think of healthcare, oftentimes what you think of is either medicine, nursing, physical therapy, and not the many other choices that are available. So
That's
wonderful.
Good.
I have another question. I've always wondered, and it may be naive, I've never really had a chance to talk to you about it before, but you know, what are the opportunities for Cuesta to collaborate with Cal Poly in some way, shape, or form to increase the enrollment or the number of graduates? You know, Cal Poly has a reputation, learn by doing, and a lot of the things that really pertain to nursing, and I, again, I'm sure there's all kinds of financial reasons and political reasons and staffing reasons and the like, and I'm just curious if you've explored that before and
we've explored having a 2+2 where you had two years at the associate degree and then you went to Poly and did 2 years. Poly has, and I think some of that is an impacted college, has never in the 35 years I've been here had any interest in a nursing program.
Is there some way we could stimulate them to be more interested? Because, again, it's a tremendous shortage that we need to deal with.
I guess you could talk to Warren Baker and tell him. I have told him, but y'all might have more clout. It's never been, as far as I know, further than, do you think this is a collaboration? It has been a no. That is, you know, just not a focus that we can do.
What's your personal opinion? Does the opportunity exist? Do you think it's because of impaction or because they're not interested, or what's?
I think they're honestly not interested. We haven't really explored this, but there are a few community colleges that have been given dispensation or whatever. I mean, I'm sure that's not the term, but have been given permission to be able to do BS programs. And I think that might be a more viable option for Cuesta to look at, you know, to be able to develop internally our own 2+2 kind of a program. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I don't know all that's involved with that, but I have heard some discussion on campus about that might be a way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that our local hospitals are certainly very, very interested in getting more BSN graduates.
Mr. Montoya.
Dr. Parker, I have two questions. One is, the associate degree, I assume, is for a RN level position?
Correct.
Do you also offer courses for LVN at Cuesta College?
No. Alan Hancock has an LVN program. And we did years ago, probably 30 years ago, we had an LVN program. And there was not, the decision was made to close the LVN program because they were having problems finding jobs. I do know that the community, the extended care facilities would like more VNs. I think that Hancock meets that need as far as I know.
Okay.
And I don't believe that Cuesta would be developing a VN program. I think we would look at maybe developing a BSN program before we would do a VN program.
My second question is your class made up, and does it reflect the community in terms of ethnically, racially, bilingually, what, you know, provisions do you provide for in helping the assistant get in to work through that process?
Well, there's quite a bit of support prior to the nursing program that is available for people who might be ESL. I don't think statewide any of us have come up with a real, real effective strategy for dealing with ESL issues. I mean, you have to be pretty fluent to be able to be successful in a nursing program. So, for example, if you're still, you know, doing the translating and you're doing your critical thinking in non-English, that can make it very difficult for you in a nursing program. There is in some of the communities that have very, very large non-English populations, for example, in the LA area, attempts to develop some strategies that will help the ESL student be successful in a program. One of the things that we've done that has worked out well, we've had a number of students who happen to be bilingual and bicultural that have gone through the program. And for example, if we had a first-year student who seemed to be struggling or having a hard time, I would contact one of them or contact a nurse in the community and ask them if they would be willing to work with them to help them in terms of, you know, having a role model, having somebody that could maybe help relate more to some of the issues that they're struggling with.
And does your curriculum include some kind of coursework that involves getting the students aware of cultural diversity and those kind of issues?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Now, we don't do another language, but we definitely have a very big, as a matter of fact, we spent 3 days totally revising our curriculum last spring, a year ago, that to really look at and enhance the cultural part of our curriculum.
Thank you.
Commissioner Warren.
Yeah, I have some questions on that kind of revolve around the wait list, and we're hearing that all the colleges have a wait list, and yet we're hearing that there's this huge nursing shortage. At the same time, San Luis Obispo County demographics are rapidly changing to where we have many more retirees moving in here, and they're not all necessarily going to need the services of an RN. So I'm kind of confused about the maybe not looking at both ends of the spectrum here with maybe not having a program for LVNs, maybe to pick up some of that wait list and help with the needs of the county. And what are we doing around reentry folks, you know, gals that are coming back for a career after they've raised their children?
I would, well, reentry at Cuesta is classified as having been out of school, I think, for 6 years and over 25. And probably 80% of our students would classify as reentry in that category. So I think that in some respects, we might be the biggest reentry program, I mean, single program on campus. Have a lot of students that come back and are seeking nursing for multiple different reasons as a second career. We do have other programs other than the RN program. We have a CNA program. We have a med assisting program. We have a psych tech program. We have an EMT program. So we have, it's not just an RN program. We have a number of others that might address some of that. And I will say for the students that are on the wait list, we do encourage them to take some of those classes. And that may be one of the biggest reasons that the students that come to us now seem to really have a sense of, a better sense of what it's about. So we haven't had those people, ooh, I didn't know I was going to have to touch people. I'm not doing this. No, we, you know, so. An LVN program is, again, a very expensive operation, and I think that with the RN program that we have, economically as well as community need-wise, it would probably be a better fit for us to expand our RN program.
Thank you very much for coming.
Okay. Do y'all want my card?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, dear. I didn't want that. I'll leave it over here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see. How about while our wise panel gets ready to come forward, why don't we take a five-minute break and reconvene at 7:25. Oh, all right, excuse me. I guess my watch is not correct. Let's, it's 7:30. Welcome back. We're back from our little break. And now I would like to welcome actually five nurses who are out in the field, are touching patients, are making significant contributions. And I think that so many times there is a question mark about what is it that a nurse really does? And what kinds of nursing, what types of nursing are there? And does a nurse always work in a hospital, or does a nurse always do a certain thing and practice in a certain environment? And so there are five nurses on our panel this evening who will tell you from five different areas, and I would like to introduce them, and then we'll start from one end of the table and progress to the other, and they will share with you some of what brings them the greatest joy and satisfaction in their job, what are some of their biggest challenges, what they would like us as the Health Commission and you in the audience and at home to know specifically about why it is that they continue to choose to practice nursing and to be involved with people in such an in-depth way. And And what are some of the things that in these various environments are happening with result with respect to recruitment and retention efforts? So we'll get to hear a bit about what's going on in our community this evening. So I would like to introduce Sherry Stoddard, who is a labor and delivery nurse at Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center. And then next to her is June Stanley, who works as an advanced practice nurse at Cal Poly in their health clinic. And then next we have Janice Kalari, who is a home care nurse and who works with Marion Home Care in the satellite, well, actually in the North County office in Templeton. And then we have Donna Silva, who is the coordinator of pediatrics, and she works with hospice partners of the Central Coast. And last but in no way least is Irene Vega, who is a public health nurse, and she is the supervisor of a program for first-time mothers and does home visitations. And so the two people, actually there are three out of five panel members that actually see people in their home environments and spend probably very little time in a hospital. So welcome to all of you, and if we could start with you, Sherry, and thank you all for coming before Sherry gets started.
Thanks, Deborah. I have been a labor and delivery nurse for 21 years, 18 of which have been here in this community. And Deborah actually asked us to speak to certain things, so I'll just do that. One of the questions was, what brings you the greatest joy and satisfaction in your work? And I think probably a lot of people could guess that on labor and delivery. I mean, it's a really neat place to work. But the main thing is, I guess, I feel that I can make a difference in somebody's hospital stay. I am there usually the trusted person who can help them deal with other people in the profession, be it their doctor or other people that they have interactions with while they're in the hospital. Help them when they're in a time that's particularly vulnerable, that they may be very fearful about. Usually it's very happy in my area, but when it's sad, it's tragic. And I feel that I can make a difference there. I've had a lot of patients tell me that, and that's a very satisfying feeling. I don't think too many people forget their nurses when they're in a difficult situation. A lot of people in the community come up to me and tell me I was their labor nurse, and it was great, and they remember that, and as indeed I remember my labor nurses. So it's very rewarding in that way. What are some of my biggest challenges? There are a gazillion of them. I love the job. I love taking care of the patients, but I'm very fond of saying that I hate the politics of working in a hospital. We have, in this area, we have a lack of beds. We have a lack of staff. I think a lot of hospitals have a lack of staff, but I don't necessarily think that all areas have lack of beds. It's difficult always to provide the kind of care that I want to provide due to both of those things and other political things that happen. One of my particular challenges is that I personally feel that healthcare is a right that everybody should have, not a privilege that some people should have and some people should not have, and that the health of a community in general is very dependent on the health of every single one of its people. So if we have a lot of people who are uninsured, that affects everybody. So some of the challenges that I face, I feel, come with that, come with the people who haven't maybe gotten some health care and then come into us in a very, in a much more acute or much more ill situation than others, sometimes with contagious things that we don't know about until they get there. But my main concern is that health care be for everybody who needs it. And that's a challenge because that's not the way it's set up in this area, nor is it set up anywhere else in this country. We were also asked to speak about recruitment and retention of nurses. That's a difficult one also. A lot more is being done, in my opinion, at least from what I see, to recruit than to retain, and which I think is a big mistake. I think that the two need to work together and they need to be equally looked at. I do know that at where I work that there are bonuses of $5,000 and $10,000 paid to nurses who will sign on for a year. Once that year is up, they're free to go. What winds up happening in this community is that we train younger nurses. They get the $5,000 or $10,000 bonus, and they can't afford to stay here. If they're younger, if they're not committed, they don't already have a house, they don't already have a family, they go elsewhere. So I'm not so sure how well things like that work in terms of retention. In fact, they don't work well in terms of retention. Those of us who are in the average age group of nurse, which I think is 47 now, and are hoping to retire at a decent age before we're really damaged physically. a lot of us want to stay with our jobs, but the job is very demanding. It's demanding physically, emotionally, and mentally in so many ways. And I would like to see more being done to promote retention of nurses as we are aging. As it was mentioned before, we're going to need more nurses. The new nurses coming in especially need mentors, and we could do that. There are some hospitals in the area that have retiree health and pension, and most of the hospitals do not. I think that would be a great thing for nurses, for someone who's provided most of their working life taking care of others, that we shouldn't have to retire without health care, things like that. I think the thing that I would like to share most with the Health Commission is that I think most of the problems in healthcare are systematic. I do think it is because of the system that we have. I think the system that we have in this country is broken, and I don't think that the things that we can do, I think that the things that we do right now to try and fix it are Band-Aids. We're trying to put a Band-Aid on an artery that's been severed. And it doesn't work anymore. And I think we really need to look at universal single-payer health care. I think that when somebody who has no access to a regular physician who happens to have tuberculosis for some reason or other and comes into an emergency room, that's all our problem, whether we have health insurance or not. And I also believe that most people, a lot of working people, don't have health insurance. We all pay for that. I don't resent paying for that, but I do see that it should be more equitable, and I believe that's the way to make it equitable, and to have a single layer, a single quality of health care for everybody is the way to go. Thanks.
Thank you very much. June.
Thank you for inviting me here today. As an advanced practice nurse, I thought I would first start just to give a little background information on what advanced practice nursing is. I think a lot of people are confused with our role and confuse us with physician assistants and some other roles that are out there. The four roles that are included in advanced practice nursing are the certified nurse midwives. They have been around for many years. They've been around the longest, since about the 1600s. We have the nurse anesthetists, and they as well have been providing care since the late 1800s. And then we have the clinical nurse specialists, who are usually seen more as an educator role. And then the newest role is the nurse practitioner role. And as far as the nurse practitioner role started in 1965, Dr. Henry Silver and Loretta Ford at the University of Colorado developed it as seeing a need for care for the well out in the community, especially at that time it was for pediatrics, and providing nurses who are competent in assessing and providing diagnostic care and generally for the well community that is out there. And so I don't know if I'm totally representing everyone here at the table. I know that one of the reasons NPs were established was one of the things that Sherry was addressing is that nurse practitioners usually increase access to care. 68% see Medi-Cal patients, 51% see the uninsured, and 27% care for the indigent. And this is a national statistic. This is not local, but it's probably fairly close. As far as the joys and satisfaction, I think anyone who is a provider for care knows what a joy it is to establish a trusting relationship with your patients and to have the follow-up on over the years or on a regular basis to see them through those passages, whether it's through childbirth or through a death or through any level of wellness that we can be there for. And I know I was in family practice. Presently, I'm at Cal Poly. I was in family practice with the Arroyo Medical Group for 9.5 years. Prior to that, I did administration and home health care. This is before I went to graduate school to get my master's and my nurse practitioner. I've been in hospice, home health, administration, medical, surgical, oncology research, and walk-in clinic in Baltimore. So the opportunities, when you talk about it, I'd love to be able to go to the high schools and talk about what opportunities really there are for nursing. It's great. And it's international, the opportunities, and it's at all levels. Some of the biggest challenges, as an advanced practice nurse, I think they're very similar to what other providers, physicians are facing right now, which is the reimbursement issue, which is has been an issue in this county for quite a while, especially since we are designated as a rural area. Our reimbursement is very low, and unfortunately, nurse practitioners are reimbursed less than physicians. And I think that you have probably heard the dilemma with recruiting and retaining physicians to the area. The same is really with the nurse practitioner role. It's not where, as far as recruitment and retention, it's not a problem where I'm at Cal Poly. Of course, it's a great environment as far as retirement and health care, which most nurse practitioners do not get to reap those benefits in private practice. As far as what I would request from you as the commission, especially to support, again, the legislative issues regarding the reimbursement to this area. I know that I'm also part of our organization, the Advanced Practice Nurse and PAs of the Central Coast, and we have people coming to visit from other areas in the state. And when they find out what average salary is in the area and obviously the cost of living here, it's very difficult for them to make the change to move here. So thank you.
Hello. I'm Janice, and I'm delighted to be here, too. And I work in home care, and I've been a nurse for 35 years, and the last 20 years have been in home care. So I think that it's probably one of my very favorite areas of nursing, although I did hospital nursing prior to that. And it's a focus where you wouldn't, and as a matter of fact, you can't even come into home care unless you've had at least 2 or 3 years of practice nursing, because you're out there on your own and you have to make a lot of independent decisions. But once you have that comfort level, then it's a wonderful job and a wonderful opportunity. So the joy that I experience from my job, I would summarize by saying that it has been a real gift to have a certain amount of knowledge and ability to promote healthy lifestyles and also to enter into helping people to relieve their pain and suffering in those more difficult times, be that physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual. And I see nursing as a science as well as an art, and I enjoy both parts of it. And in home care, my joy comes from those previously mentioned areas as well as the opportunity and privilege to really enter into a person's home and into their very lifestyle. And I used to always remember thinking about the caregivers that you meet along the way in this job are just some of the most beautiful people that you can meet. We see, you know, husbands that sometimes have difficulty being caregivers, and yet some can just become these incredible, totally devoted kinds of persons. And of course, it goes both ways. When I went to nursing school many years ago, it was always stressed that you need to be providing total patient care. Well, in my early years in hospital, that was a nice goal, but it wasn't very realistic because there was just so much work to do that you did your best, but it wasn't always very possible to have a lot of time to develop relationship. So that's what thing that's very special about home care. And the challenges that I'm aware of, and I guess I'm most aware of these challenges because of having only lived in this area for 2 years, and prior to that I was living in the state of Washington. And it may be different there now, but only 2 years ago the state was reimbursing to the medically indigent at a higher level, and it really made a difference. When I first came here, I couldn't believe the difference. And where the specific differences are, there's a real need in all community now in healthcare for assisted living, that in-between time when they can't live at home anymore safely, maybe they don't have the caregivers available or even existing, and yet they're not appropriate for a skilled nursing facility. And so there are these assisted living places that are being built, but they are very, very expensive, and the state doesn't get involved in reimbursement in those areas at all. And the same thing is true of board and care, which is another can be a very helpful means of providing that in-between kind of assisted living. And again, in Washington, the state would give the reimbursement to a board and care center in the same way that they would give it to a nursing home. So, it filled that gap, and I see now so many people that need assisted living, but they can't afford it, and so we have to discharge them into the community knowing that they are going to fail because they just can't remember to take their medications regularly, and there's no one to remind them, you know, diabetics that can't monitor their disease well. So that's kind of been a frustration that I've seen. And the other is the frustration that I've alluded to with this problem with this low reimbursement to this area. And so I quite often see people, again, they're usually the Medicaid or the Medi-Cal people that have been, you know, maybe they've had open heart surgery, they've had motor vehicle accidents, they've been in the hospital, they get all the care they need in the hospital, and then they're discharged, and sometimes we can't even find a physician that will follow up with them. Many of the specialists in the North County, there is not one cardiologist that will see a Medi-Cal patient. You know, I have a problem with that. I know that the reimbursement is poor, but I just think that that somehow there should be some kind of a system. They do have the CHC clinics, but they are so busy, and the doctors there do an incredible job for what they have to do, but that's another thing. There's no emergency, urgent care places for the Medi-Cal people to go. So we end up sending them to the hospital when oftentimes that isn't the right place for them, and it's in a very expensive way to meet medical needs by having to send these people that really don't need to be in the hospital. So those are frustrations, challenges that I've seen just in the home care. In terms of recruitment for new nurses, to my knowledge, it hasn't been a real big problem in home care, because usually home care nurses, they've been around for quite a while, and they have oftentimes been in the hospital and then chosen to go into home care, and because there's a lot of satisfaction in that area of nursing, I don't think there's as much of a problem as there is in the hospitals. And I feel like the reimbursement has been good with the help that we've had from the union and such. So I haven't had concerns in that area. A lot of nurses will be frustrated with the paperwork involved, but there's paperwork everywhere. Every job has its paperwork. So my specific requests, I guess, for the Health Commission would be to continue to work on the Medicaid and Medi-Cal problems of reimbursement, to focus on the county's needs for reimbursement, and maybe even a program that would encourage more development of the Borden Care Centers, because they can fill a very good need in the community. They do tend to be less expensive than even the official assisted living facilities that are built for that purpose. And to continue to support the in-home support program, because that is one program that does meet some of the need for the indigent people in providing care. And I guess I don't know if you have a role in lobbying, but certainly Medicaid should not be cut. I just think that that's going to be a huge mistake if we cut back in our Medicaid, because we only will increase our expenses in hospitalization, and we end up paying for it that way. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you. Donna.
I'm Donna, and I've been a nurse now for about 23 years. Started out very young, and have three girls, and they don't want to be nurses, and I'm trying to figure out why. And so I'm a hospice nurse. My greatest joy and satisfactions, I think, when you work with people that are dying, it's just kind of a calling, and I've been doing it now 5 years. Mm-hmm. I've been a pediatric nurse for the years before that, worked in a big city, 1,000-bed hospital and ICU and pediatrics. And so I'm the nurse who coordinates pediatric care in our community when a child is very ill. And cure is no longer an option, but certainly parents never want to give up. So in the hospice setting, we have the privilege of presenting choices at the end of life for both adults and children. And there's just a great satisfaction in doing that, being able to just walk with people through very intense things. But managing symptoms that can be very awful well. We're very good at pain management, symptom management, and also addressing the emotional, spiritual, all the family dynamics that come in to a family when you're having that happen to you. And so can be sad, but the work itself isn't sad. It's very gratifying, and there's lots of joy and life. Even in the dying process, there's lots of living that happens, and we get to see that day to day and meet some of very amazing people along the way. Challenges, the thing that I thought of as a nurse living in this area now for about 11 years have been competitive wages and affordable housing for the workforce. You know, I'm not poor by any means, but have a hard time affording owning a home. So I think that's a big thing in our community right now for our workforce, you know, and being able to look to the future. And I would love for my kids to get married and stay here, and I don't know if that will be able to happen at this point. So that's a challenge for probably a lot of people, but that's one of the challenges I see. Where I work, recruitment, there's a nursing shortage, and we feel it. We have a high census, and we don't have enough nurses right now, so we're advertising and that kind of a thing. So I just think, in general, there's a nursing shortage. There's a high satisfaction in the job, just like you said, so we don't see a high turnover. Like, I've been there 5 years, and many of my colleagues have been there longer, some of them from beginning when it was county and all of that. So we don't see a high turnover, but you need highly qualified individuals, and it's hard to find those individuals. We do have programs for reentry nurses, nurses that have been out of the nursing for a long time, raising families. We've gone to the even extreme of getting a waiver so that we could have a nurse come in that had been out of practice for over 10 years, I believe, and now she's working beautifully. It was a year program. That's a big commitment financially on the agency's part, and you have to go through the political process of getting a waiver, but we do that. One of the information I would like to share with the Health Commission and members of the community would be that for hospice, it would be great if we could raise awareness that it's hospice work and referrals are not for just those last 2 weeks or 2 days of when you're really actively dying. Our best work happens when we get an early referral and we get to work with people for, I like to say, 3 months or more. 6 weeks is probably would be really more attainable, but often we get somebody who's just in their last days, and that is just not the best effective hospice kind of nursing. And sometimes that's just an education level. People don't realize that they can be fairly healthy and be in a hospice program, and especially if you're not seeking curative treatment. You just say, hey, I don't want to do chemo anymore, but you're still running around visiting and living life. You can be in a hospice program and get a lot of support. And so that's something that is a need. And in our community, it would be wonderful. My big wish list as a hospice nurse is I would love to have an inpatient hospice in our community. Many states have those. We do not. I think San Diego Hospice is one of the closest ones that has. That's a hospice where you can go if you're dying and your family can't take care of you at home or you don't want to be at home, but there's nowhere else to go. You can go to a hospice where it's a 24-hour care facility, but it's not a hospital. It's a place where you can die comfortably in a home-like setting. And I'm not sure of all the political and financial barriers, but there are none around anywhere. So that's a big need, and this community especially could really use that. People who have moved here from other states ask, well, where's the hospice that you go to die? And there is none. So that is a thing that I would love to see in our community. And then I guess that would fall under specific requests for the Health Commission, but I think part of just being a nonprofit organization and a small one, I mean, the cost of health care liability, workmen's compensation, all of those reimbursement issues is probably one of the biggest challenges that we have. I mean, to keep the doors open kind of thing. So, thank you.
And I'm Irene Vega. I'm a very enthusiastic advocate of nursing. I have 38 years of experience, and when I first came into nursing, I came in at the associate degree level and worked in a hospital, worked practically every area that there was, but settled and preferred the intensive care unit, developed my skills and worked in coronary care unit there, worked in a doctor's office for a while between deciding to go back to the hospital, and I have been very fortunate to have experienced what the other nurses have said about this profession, giving us avenues to develop ourselves in areas that are of our interests. And as a result of that, I was able to be a head nurse, an educator. I worked in adults, pediatrics, and the last place I worked in a hospital at Huntington Memorial in Pasadena was a neonatal nurse and did discharge coordination there. I came here to San Luis Obispo 15 years ago, and that's when my public health career started. As a nurse in the hospital, I was given the opportunity to achieve my Bachelor's of Science of Nursing through the California State Consortium of Universities, which, because I had experience, allowed me to challenge out on part of my curriculum because I had years of experience. And I know they have programs similar to that here, but it's very well supported down there, and I think that's the reason why so many more nurses do get their bachelor's of science in nursing down in that area than they do here. I think she mentioned there were maybe 10 people is all that are enrolled in that type of a program here. And the difference between a nurse that's just has a bachelor's of science in nursing and one that's a public health nurse is that you are trained in public health in that four-year education, but you have to apply for your public health certificate. And not everyone does because not everyone intends to use it. And I did not until I came to San Luis Obispo and became a public health nurse. So having worked in field visitation for several years, I took a job as a supervisor and have had the privilege of working in preventative work now as a public health supervisor in the First Time Mothers program. And just to give you an idea of what the county does have, we have an early support program that sees women with no qualification really in terms of whether it's their first baby or not, but we have field nurses that go into their homes. First Time Mothers program is for a mom first time. She has to be under the poverty level, 200% of the poverty level. And she has to be entered into the program before she reaches 29 weeks gestation. And this is one of the things that that gives me so much joy about this program is that we are able to make a difference when you can still make a difference. And so there's a lot of prevention in this program in that you are able to engage a woman when she's early on in her pregnancy. And some of our referrals are even when the mother is just 9 weeks pregnant. And sometimes we have to kind of back off because they don't recognize they need help until they realize they're pregnant and, you know, start identifying with that. So that's one of the biggest joys that I have. And I also took a client while I was, even though I'm a program manager, I had a client that just graduated from the program. And it is a joy to meet someone when they're pregnant and have not had their child yet, work with them. And this young woman did not speak English, and so I was able to case manage her in Spanish. And she graduated in April with her child being 2 years of age. And she has not gotten pregnant again. And the odds were great that she would have. She is interested now in getting herself into a school system to take English as a second language. She has standards for herself now about what she can accept in the way of a lifestyle that she wouldn't have had before. And this story is repeated over and over and over again from the other public health nurses that work in this program and in the other field visitation programs. So I believe we do make a difference. All of us make a difference in a different way, in a different part of people's lives. And as far as the challenges, it's, you know, the pay is not all that great. When I came up here from Pasadena, I took a huge cut in pay to be able to work in this section of the industry. And I think I would have earned more in a hospital, but not a whole lot. And then also because of budget constraints, you know, it takes a long time to train people to be public health nurses, and we just had a position cut, you know. So we've lost a field nurse. For our full county, we have approximately 15 what you would consider full-time equivalent positions. There are, I believe, 22 nurses that make up that 15 FTEs. And so many of them are part-time, but we were just cut back one. So we'll be able to serve less people now than we were before. We all have wait lists, and it's very hard, you know, to have referrals coming in constantly. They come into the office where I work, and I triage them. And it's difficult to decide which ones are going to get case managed and which ones are not and which ones are going to be put on wait lists. And that's a huge challenge, I think, even for a public health nurse who gets a referral and has a caseload. In the First Time Mothers program, we are maxed at 25. We're only allowed 25 cases, but the others can go higher, and it's very difficult to choose. In terms of recruitment and retention, we're also really lucky because we're the Central Coast. People want to come to this area, so we haven't as much trouble recruiting as other areas do. I know in L.A. they had 80 public health nurse position openings at one time that I was aware of. And retention, we work very hard at because we know that our nurses can go to other places and earn more money. And so Dr. Thomas is very much of an advocate in helping us to team build and to make sure that the nurses feel that they're appreciated. So I'm grateful about that. And in terms of what I want from the commission, I think I just would echo what the other nurses have said, you know, that we need to be supported in acknowledging the shortage and doing what we can to get young women and men into our nursing programs so that we can get people trained. I feel certainly that there are nurses out there right now who have degrees who are choosing not to work. I have three friends of my own who are doing real estate and who are doing other things rather than nursing because of the difficulties that they've had in the field. So there are nurses out there right now that we're not tapping. We're looking at training new people. So thank you very much for having us.
Before I open it up to any questions or comments from the commission, I know that June had some feedback for Commissioner Warren. Do you want to?
When you were talking about the LVN need, and I was wondering if you had meant that that was to fulfill the convalescent center or skilled nursing facility role with the aging population. Okay, because actually, and as it's been addressed here, the big need is going to be for management of chronic illness and the assisted living care, and it's amazing that really is less than 20% of the geriatric population that ever ends up, or it's actually less than that ever ends up in a convalescent center. But so sometimes that role for LVN is not necessarily would be utilized in what the need is that's out there.
Thank you. Any comments from the commissioners or questions that came up? I just want to thank all of you for coming. One of the things that certainly a common thread that I heard in each person's sharing was the challenges with reimbursement, and that this county, it has been designated as a rural county, and the reimbursement has been very low for physicians, which we have discussed in this particular health commission setting, not this year, but it has come forward when we talked about access to care. And it affects nurse practitioner reimbursement. It affects, I found out actually last week that it also affects home care reimbursement, and that there is certainly an aspect to one agency who is a not-for-profit agency who has specified that a nurse must see a certain number of patients to accommodate, because the particular agency also takes care of quite a high number of CMSP patients and Medi-Cal patients. And so part of what I was told was that a nurse's day has a certain number of patients and that number does not vary. And a part of that is the reason, or the part of that is the low reimbursement for the Medi-Cal population, the Medicare population, and the CMSP population. So nurses are really being asked to carry more on their shoulders for the situation that exists in our county. And I am feeling like one of the things that Lois Capps needs to be encouraged to continue to do is to look at the designation of this county and get the rural designation changed. So in our letter from our health commission to her, I will make sure that that is addressed. I would like to thank each and every one of you for coming tonight and sharing, because I feel that from a personal standpoint, the more people hear about who nurses are and what we do to contribute to the people whom we serve, the better understanding there is in our local community, certainly, and in the nation at large. And, you know, the other thing that I think we can do is to really have a voice in the places where we as nurses are not being portrayed accurately. And things are getting better with television clips and shows and documentaries. But, you know, in places where we see that we as a profession or our profession is not being honored, to really write letters to the editor or, you know, come to an awareness, even if you end up sharing with someone in a supermarket, if you're, you know, you have this, the appropriate situation, to really create a greater awareness of nursing and what it is that we do. So thank you, thank you, thank you to each and every one of you for coming tonight and sharing from your heart. And obviously, I've been a nurse for over 25 years, and I have a special place for each and every one of you and all of you who are watching at home in our community. Thank you very much. Now, on our agenda, the next item is Public Health Department report. And I know that it says that Dr. Greg Thomas is going to give the Public Health Department report. And as you might know, Dr. Thomas has changed a little bit since our last meeting. So I would like to say that Mr. Jess Montoya is going to give the Public Health Department report. And so, Mr. Montoya.
Thank you. I'm going to try to fill the shoes of Dr. Thomas. It's going to be a little difficult, but I'll do my best. Dr. Thomas and I have been talking, and what we've decided is that one of us will be attending this meeting. Usually on different occasions. Either he'll be here or I'll be here, but there will be times when we both come to this meeting when it's appropriate. So we just wanted to acknowledge and let the commission know of that. The second thing that I wanted to talk about briefly was that we're starting our budget hearings next week on Monday. As you know, we probably have had some cuts in our budget, minimal cuts, as Ms. Vega was alluding to. We did have one public health nurse position cut, and that was tied because of our reimbursement for what's called targeted case management. So as the industry is being affected by reimbursement, we were also affected and lost targeted case management monies that were specifically tied to that public health nurse position. And so because we had a vacancy, we went ahead and made that adjustment. We did have other adjustments in the agency, some minimal cuts there as well as in mental health. But overall, we're trying to either transfer people within the system to other vacant positions, or the cuts that have been unoccupied positions. Should I just present out and then, okay. The third topic is behavioral health director, as you know, and I think Dr. Thomas has reported out. We did a recruitment. We went through a series of negotiations with one individual. The individual basically was offered a higher level position in his existing organization. So the person decided to stay there. We have been talking to another individual who is also our second candidate, very strong, very good skills, has experience in both California and Texas. And the biggest issue is that because we've been trying to do the background with people in, out of the area, it's been a little bit more difficult, especially in Texas. And so consequently, we're getting through it. Hopefully by next month, we'll have something positive to report. The Mental Health Services Act Forum have been going on. There have been three held to date. The fourth one will be held this Thursday in Atascadero. And what we're doing is asking for community input on how the Mental Health Services Act money should be utilized and how they should enhance existing services. What we hope to do is basically take the input from the forums. In addition, we have focus groups, and then we have outreach into other community areas. And we're basically drawing all of these inputs, and we're going to formulate a plan. We also have done a telephone survey. We've done a provider survey, and we're doing a general interested individual survey. And so what we hope to do is pull that all that information together, start to formulate a plan, and then come back to the Mental Health Board and the Board of Supervisors in early November. with the expectation that there probably will be some tweaking in that process. But hopefully by November, if we can get the plan in place, it's going to take the state probably 2 to 3 months to review the plan, notify us, so we don't expect any revenue in the county until probably April to possibly July of next year. So I think it's important that people understand that. I think the other thing that's important is that people believe that this is a lot of money, and the reality is it's probably not going to be as much, and so there may be a sense that the expectations might outrun the needs, and so that is a concern that we have. But I think through this process, some of the things that I have found is very important, as I think they're really forcing us as a community to collaborate where we can kind of leverage monies and possibly actually do a better job in that area. And I think that's one of the positive outcomes. A couple of other themes that I've heard is crisis. The crisis follow-up kind of issues in the community are a major concern. When people come out of our psychiatric inpatient facility, doing case management is another important aspect. Something that I hadn't really heard but has come out of the forums is the need to spend more time in education with the parents and working with the parents to support some of the things that they're doing. So I think that's been very beneficial. So just to give you a sense of the dollars, we're anticipating $2.3 million for one of the components of the plan. The guidelines are still in draft form, but we are moving forward with one particular aspect. I saw one of our commissioners there this last week, so she may want to share her input. In terms of the last issue, Dr. Thomas wanted me to share with you all a position that the board had taken recently on smart growth and what are the implications for health-related issues. And so should I go ahead and give these to Jean, or should I pass them out?
Pass them out.
Okay. Yeah, I'll briefly summarize this for you all, and you can read it at your leisure. Just to highlight a couple of important points, the board adopted some guiding principles on smart growth with the idea that we're starting to look at how development affects health-related issues. The importance of this is that when you have walkable communities, you have better health outcomes that occur. You have better mental health outcomes, and that's been documented through a number of forums. There's an individual named Andre Duanis who works in Southern California, but who's also a consultant throughout the nation. And one of the things that he's emphasized in his trainings is that when you do good development, you actually benefit your community by reducing heart attacks, strokes, and those kind of initiatives. So now whenever you attend a smart growth conference, one of the components is a breakout session usually on how that ties to health-related issues. In essence, the board has adopted these guiding principles, and under item number 8 on the third page, it talks about walkable neighborhoods and towns. And I think that's going to be a major focus. As development occurs, most of the other principles here support really item number 8. But what's important is that there should be, in essence, I think what the board is saying from an overarching perspective is as development occurs, there ought to be some themes that should be considered, those being that we should do infilling wherever we can in the communities that are already there, that the communities, as they develop, they should have biking, public transit, walking, and driving. I think this community does a better job than some communities, but there's still probably some opportunities for growth in that area. talking about mixed-use choices occurring in the county as you develop your construction makes a lot of good sense. For example, in Contra Costa County, there is one community that has done a very good job with mixed use, where, for example, they have apartments that are built above the commercial businesses, and as a consequence, it's really helped the whole walkable process. The studies have indicated that if people have to walk more than three-quarters of a mile, they generally aren't going to do that beyond that. So as we start to develop community themes and community building, such as in Arroyo Grande, the village, I think that kind of a concept makes a lot of sense, and I think that, that the board supported the concept with a 5-0 vote. That's pretty much Greg's report, and I'm reporting out on his behalf. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Montoya?
Well, I'd just like to say that Mr. Montoya, when he came, there were disastrous potential budget problems this coming year. He has come up working with the whole agency with basically a status quo budget, I call it. There are some cuts, and I think he should be commended for that very much.
Yes. Thank you very much. We appreciate all your hard work.
Well, I'd like to acknowledge it was a team effort. I definitely couldn't have done it with all the managers. We made some assumptions based on some good background analysis, and so we're hoping that those come to fruition. And if our estimates are a little bit off, we'll make those adjustments to balance out the end of the year. I'm talking about the next fiscal year. So, and I would like to indicate you know, support to the CAO's office because we had to go through a process with them. They wanted a lot of extra data. We were able to work out some of those issues. We are going to have some ongoing discussions on how realignment, which is sales tax and vehicle license fees, should be distributed between the health agency and Department of Social Services. There's also an implication of how CCS fits into that whole pattern of funding. And so rather than get into a defensive mode, we're going to take the next 6 months to kind of work out some of those background issues so that when we get into the next budget year, I think the process will flow much better. And all of these recommendations will ultimately be determined by the Board of Supervisors. They have full final decision in that process.
Thank you.
Sure.
And thank you for coming to the meetings.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
With regard to public health issues, I was just curious where we are at this point in time with mosquito abatement, West Nile virus reporting, if you know.
I only know in general. I think Dr. Thomas could have definitely given you an overview. I read a memo several weeks ago, and there had been probably less than 20 dead birds that had been identified. There had been no human cases, but other than that, I don't remember the detail.
Okay. Thank you. Next item on our agenda is Health Commissioner updates, and I guess I'm first on the docket. So I talked with Marsha Bollinger, who's the co-chair of the HIV Care Consortium, and she said that from the last meeting, in April, that there really weren't any updates for us as the commission to act on. So that was my follow-through on that. And tonight is my last meeting as chair of the Health Commission, and I just really want to extend a heartfelt thank you to each and every one of you for all the help that you have given, the support that you have given, the commitments that you have made to attend different meetings in different areas. And it certainly is not possible to take on the role of chair without a lot of support. And I really mean it when I say thank you. And I want to extend a special thank you to Jean White, because if it were not for her, there would have been a lot more stress for me. And she certainly has been a wonderful, wonderful support to me and made this year really a wonderful experience. And in addition to all of you, really, I thank you for everything this year, because I've received a lot of support. And I also want to say that recently, since our last meeting, actually, and in the last couple of weeks, some big changes have happened in my life, and I have been offered a new position, and I have accepted it. And so my time commitment is going to be greatly increased, and so I'm going to resign my position on the commission as well. And it saddens me to do that, but it's just what is up for me to do. So I wish you all the best. Okay. Commissioner update. Commissioner Wood.
Okay.
Commissioner Horn. Commissioner Hicks.
I'm very sorry to hear that you're going to be resigning. You've been a wonderful addition to the Health Commission, and I have to just say that on behalf of all of us. I also have to agree with you that we all do better because of Gene. And Gene, thank you for everything that you do for us. We really appreciate you. My update is I missed the SART meeting held in May, but I did get the minutes, and I spoke with Deborah, who is the supervisor of SART. Some of the discussion was them moving into the ER area as soon as the pharmacy that CHC is now occupying moves into the annex, and that's still the space in the ER area is still being discussed. And translation services was the other big item. The translation committee did meet, and they met with some outside agencies, including medical agencies, and discussed how often they will meet, the training, funding, competency, testing, and volunteers. And our next meeting will be in August. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hale.
I met with the nominating committee, and Jan will be giving you a report from that tonight, I'm sure. With regard to specifics, I met with the CHC physician and nurse practitioner and directors group. I guess they have a monthly meeting. The last one was at the bank in Templeton. I met with them trying to promote better interaction between their staff and our staff in ER and the hospital, and invite them to come and participate on committee activities and other governing activities with regard to the ER and the hospital in the North County, and was very cordially and well received, and anticipate that that relationship will continue to grow and work. Other than that, it's just some work with community education.
Commissioner O'Dell?
You know, the Mental Health Board is looking forward to the retaining of a director of the very, very much. And also in Prop 63, you gave the update on that. And we're going to miss you. You've done a great job, and we understand. Thank you.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, with the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board, they Vivian Saylor was there this past meeting to talk about the relationship with the FAIR Board, which is something that's been going on for a couple of years, and they're looking at some of the advertising issues for alcohol at the FAIR, some of the incidences that happen, and particularly access for youth. So they're really doing a good job in looking at some of those issues and working on that. They decreased a lot of the advertising for the different liquor outlets and made them less accessible to the kids and that type of thing. So they're still working on that. And this evening I gave you a little packet because at the July 14th meeting, which will be at noon over at Drug and Alcohol Services, they're going to have a platform discussion on binge drinking. in San Luis County and some of those particular issues. So they had given us a packet in front to review some of the statistics and things. So I did bring those in for the commission members tonight in case anybody wanted to take a look at that and maybe come to that particular meeting. And I, too, want to thank you so much for all that you've done and kind of been a mentor to me in this first year. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now we have committee reports. Legislative committee? Legislative?
No meeting.
Okay. And moving right along, nominating committee.
The nominating committee met on Wednesday, May 25th in the Public Health Department. We discussed officers for next year and have made the following recommendations. Lynn Enns, chair. Myself, Jan Hicks, vice chair. Penny Chamusa, secretary. And the other thing that we would like to ask for as a recommendation is due to the increased responsibility of the chair and other time commitments and constraints, it's been recommended by the nominating committee that the chair and vice chair share by coordinating monthly meetings and alternate who will chair the meeting monthly.
Okay, so this is an action item. And does anybody, before we put it to action, does anybody have any comments that they would like to add? Commissioner O'Dell, I Oh, okay. Okay. Anybody? Okay. So I'll entertain a motion to adopt the recommendations of the nominating committee for next year's officers.
All right, so move.
Second.
Okay. We have a first and a second. All agree in agreement?
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing no opposed, the officers have now been nominated and received.
Commissioner, Chair, or Chair, I have one other comment I need to make.
Okay.
We were also informed by Jean that we had 11 calls for alternate health commission applications and 5 actual applications have been received. So the nominating committee will be meeting again to interview the applicants, and we will bring that back to the July meeting. And thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Community education, any update?
We're unable to get together and have a meeting because of conflicting commitments of the various members, so we kind of did this by telephone. And there were several things that were offered. Commissioner Horn offered to try to develop and promote and secure funding for a presentation to be on their television network with Dr. Oh, gosh, I'm blocking his name now. Come on, Jan. See, I wrote down here.
Oh,
Chasnov. Yeah, Dr. Chasnov's prenatal screening programs. Everybody on the committee thought that would be great, and so I would recommend that to the commission tonight. The other was just with regard to community education when we are farther along and close to be finishing with the task force that's dealing with genetic engineering of crops in San Luis Obispo County right now. I want to apologize to the Health Commission because I've not done a very good job with the community education this year. I guess I had a little bit of a different take on what our job might be, and so I want to kind of run that by people tonight, too. You just gave me tonight some information that's passed down from previous person as the chair of the Community Education Committee, and mission is listed as a couple of things. Let me read them. One is to educate the community about what the Health Commission is and how it operates, including history, member selection, posting agendas, hearing issues, making recommendations, and encouraging volunteer input and participation. I didn't realize that was part of the mission of the Education Committee, as well as to inform or educate the community about the Health Commission's recommendations to the Board of Supervisors and the health agency. We really haven't done much of that outside of just having the meetings here. I'm not quite sure how to do that, so I need to give that some more thought and talk to Penny about that since she's going to be chair of this committee next year. I thought that part of our job was to maybe bring more people to the Health Commission to talk, since our meetings are televised, about health issues, issues brought forth tonight, issues like reimbursement and, you know, single-payer systems or universal health care, current state of health care in San Luis Obispo County with regard to those issues and recruitment and staff and the like. Mm-hmm. And I think what we might be able to do is to enlist other physicians to come and talk about what they do and what they see as issues, as we had dermatologists last year come and talk about skin cancer and, mm-hmm. you know, protecting yourself and healthy lifestyle kind of things. And we could talk about things like advances in joint replacement and cardiology care and a lot of things that are going on in San Luis Obispo County now mm-hmm. that I'm not sure public has much access to unless they're sick or involved or mm-hmm. or injured or in some way, shape, or form, you know, family member, something like that. So those are some things that I thought might be valuable mm-hmm. from the Health Commission standpoint.
Well, and I would not be so quick to say that you have failed in your responsibilities because I clearly remember that we talked about, as a commission, doing whether or not we would do a booth at the during Public Health Month at the farmers market, and we had decided not to do that this year as a way of getting information, because we had done it for several years running now, and we were looking at a way to impact the public through a different forum. So it takes a while for that to get up and running. So, and I know that when Commissioner Enns took the position of chair and coach, and there's a co-chair now for the GMO task force, that she is going to come to the community education program and ask for support in terms of setting up some public forums and that kind of thing. So I don't want you to take that on as a failure. So there. And also in terms of Dr. Chazanoff, that's going to coming to the commission and reporting about, you know, the perinatal issues that perinatal alcohol abuse and the effects of that. Sarah?
He's already done that. He was here.
Right, that's what I'm saying. He did come and do that.
Yeah. And so I really think that what was proposed as far as the GMO task force, et cetera, is probably better than rehashing Dr. Chazanoff.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that we not go that route.
Yeah, so that one can be kicked around and explored. So any update from the Budget Committee? I don't think so. Okay. Now, usually, since I've been on the commission, the July meeting is kind of a planning meeting, but certainly that will be up to the next person who has the office of the chair. But some of the things that were talked about for future meetings were the tobacco cessation update from Dr. Hansen and an invitation to the CEO of Arroyo Grande Community Hospital to come to a meeting and give us an update on any new programs or ways that Arroyo Grande will be interacting in the community. And childhood obesity is another issue. And I received an email via Jean, and Jean probably, and I didn't want to leave out the CEO of Arroyo Grande Community Hospital is Mr. Rick Castro, and actually a former commission member, Claudette Redding, would like to arrange for a speaker to talk to the commission and give an update on what is happening, what's coming down the pike, she says, regarding the new federal prescription drug program called Part D Medicare. So the D as in dog, Medicare. And so those are some items that can be on a future agenda. And Mr. Montoya?
One other item that you might consider is managed care. We have begun to form a committee. We're reviewing that issue. We have speakers coming. And at some point in time, I think it might be helpful to have that whole discussion in front of the commission. The other one that Commissioner Hill pointed out and I think would be important is to come back maybe at the next meeting and talk about West Nile virus. We'll have more data at that time and more comprehensive information. So those two, I think, should be scheduled, or I throw those out for your consideration.
Okay. Commissioner Warren.
Yes, also, the Children's Services Network has just put out their summary report for the past year, mm-hmm. and it has a lot of great data on children and families mm-hmm. and working toward healthy families. And Joel Derringer presented a PowerPoint presentation for us that was really good, so I did take the liberty of asking him if that would be something he'd consider doing here, mm-hmm. and he would.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. Okay. Well, it's a time to adjourn, so I'll entertain a motion to adjourn this meeting.
Second.
Okay. Motion to adjourn has been first and seconded, and I'm going to have the last use of the gavel. Meeting adjourned.